There are very few men that can outrun me. Tunnus is the only one I know of, but he has to be on top form to do it. I put my foot in the centre of the Bedouin's back and held him down as I jerked the spearhead out of his flesh, and then I went after the last shrike. I caught him before he had gone 200 paces, and I was running so lightly that he did not hear me coming up behind him. With the edge of the spearhead I slashed the tendon in the back of his heel, and he went down sprawling. The sword flew out of his hand. As he lay on his back kicking and screaming at me, I danced around him, pricking him with the point of the spear, goading him into a position for a good, clean, killing thrust. "Which of the women did you enjoy the best?" I asked him, as I stabbed him in the thigh. "Was it the mother with her big belly, or was it the little girl? Was she tight enough for you?" "Please spare me!" he screamed. "I did nothing. It was the others. Don't kill me!" "There is dried blood on the front of your kilt," I said, and I stabbed him in the stomach, but not too deeply. "Did the child scream as loudly as you do now?" I asked. As he rolled over into a ball to protect his stomach, I stabbed him in the spine, by a lucky chance finding the gap between the vertebra. Instantly he was paralysed from the waist down, and I stepped back from him. "Very well," I said. "You asked me not to kill you, and I won't. It would be too good for you." I turned away and walked back to join Tunnus. The maimed shrike dragged himself a little way after me, his paralysed legs slithering after him like a fisherman dragging a pair of dead carp. Then the effort was too much, and he collapsed in a whimpering heap. Although it was past noon, the sun still had enough heat in it to kill him before it set. Tunnus looked at me curiously as I came back to join him. "There is a savage streak in you that I never suspected before." He shook his head in wonder. "You never fail to amaze me." He pulled the water skin from the back of the donkey and offered it to me, but I shook my head. "You first. You need it more than I do." He drank, his eyes tightly closed with the pleasure of it, and then gasped. "By the sweet breath of Isis, you are right. I am soft as an old woman. Even that little piece of swordplay nearly finished me." Then he looked around at the scattered corpses and grinned with satisfaction. "But all in all, not a bad start on Pharaoh's business." "It was the poorest of beginnings," I contradicted him. And when he crooked an eyebrow at me, I went on. "We should have kept at least one of them alive to lead us to the shrike's nest. Even that one," I gestured towards the dying man lying out there amongst the rocks, "is too far gone to be any use to us. It was my fault. I allowed my anger to get the better of me. We won't make the same mistake again." We were halfway back to where we had left the bodies of the murdered family before my true nature reasserted itself, and I began bitterly to regret my callous and brutal treatment of the maimed brigand. "After all, he was a human being, as we are," I told Tunnus, and he snorted. "He was an animal, a rabid jackal, and you did a fine job. You have mourned him far too long. Forget him. Tell me instead why we must make this detour back to look at dead men instead of heading straight for Kratos' camp." "I need the husband's body." I would say no more until we stood over the mutilated corpse. The pathetic relic was already stinking in the heat. The vultures had left very little flesh on the bones. "Look at that hair," I told Tunnus. "Who else do you know with a bush like that?" For a moment he looked puzzled, and then he grinned and ran his fingers through his own dense ringlets. "Help me load him onto the donkey," I ordered. "Kratos can take him into Karnak to the morticians for embalming. We'll buy him a good funeral and a fine tomb with your name on the walls. Then by sunset tomorrow all of Thebes will know that Tunnus, Lord Harab, perished in the desert and was half eaten by the birds." "If Lostris hears of it, though," Tunnus looked worried, "I will send a warning letter to her. The advantage we will win by letting the world believe you dead will far outweigh any risk of alarming my mistress." Kratos was camped at the first oasis on the caravan road to the Red Sea, less than a day's march from Karnak. He had with him 100 men of the Blue Crocodile Guards, all of them carefully selected, as I had commanded. Tunnus and I reached the encampment in the middle of the night. We had travelled hard and were close to exhaustion. We fell on our sleeping mats beside the campfire and slept until dawn. At first light, Tunnus was up and mingling with his men. Their delight at having him back was transparent. The officers embraced him, and the men cheered him and grinned with pride as he greeted each of them by name. At breakfast, Tanos gave Kratos instructions to take the putrefying corpse back to Karnak for burial and to make certain that the news of his death was the gossip of all Thebes. I gave Kratos a letter for my lady Lostris. He would find a trustworthy messenger to carry it upriver to Elephantine. Kratos selected an escort of 10 men, and they prepared to set off with the donkey and its odorous burden back towards the Nile and Thebes. "Try to catch up with us on the road to the sea. If you cannot, then you will find us camped at the oasis of Jebel Nagara." "We will wait for you there," Tanos shouted after him as the detachment trotted out of the encampment. "And remember to bring Lunata, my bow, when you return." No sooner was Kratos out of sight beyond the first rise on the westerly road than Tanos formed up the rest of the regiment and led us away in the opposite direction along the caravan road towards the sea. The caravan road from the banks of the River Nile to the shores of the Red Sea was long and hard. A large, unwieldy caravan usually took 20 days to make the journey. We covered the distance in 4 days, for Tanos pushed us in a series of forced marches. At the outset, he and I were probably the only ones of all the company who were not in superb physical condition. However, by the time we reached Jebel Nagara, Tanos had burned the excess fat off his frame and sweated out the last poisons from the wine jar. He was once again lean and hard. As for myself, it was the first time that I had ever made a forced march with a company of the guards. For the first few days I suffered all the torments of thirst and aching muscles, of blistered feet and exhaustion, that the car of a dead man must be forced to endure on the road to the underworld. However, my pride would not allow me to fall behind, apart from the fact that to do so in this wild and savage landscape would have meant certain death. To my surprise and pleasure, I found that after the first few days it became easier and easier to keep my place in the ranks of trotting warriors. Along the way we passed 2 large caravans moving towards the Nile, with the donkeys bow-legged under their heavy loads of trade goods, and escorts of heavily armed men far surpassing in number the merchants and their retainers who made up the rest of the company. No caravan was safe from the depredations of the shrikes, unless it was protected by a force of mercenaries such as these, or unless the merchants were prepared to pay the crippling toll money that the shrikes demanded to allow them free passage. When we met these strangers, Tanos pulled his shawl over his head to mask his face and hide that golden bush of hair. He was too distinctive a figure to risk being recognized, and his continued existence being reported in Karnak. We did not respond to the greetings and questions that were flung at us by these other travellers, but ran past them in aloof silence without even glancing in their direction. When we were still a day's march from the coast, we left the main caravan route and swung away southwards, following an ancient disused track that had been shown to me some years previously by one of the wild Bedouin whom I had befriended. The wells at Jebel Nagara lay on this old route to the sea, and were seldom visited by humans these days, only by the Bedouin and the desert bandits, if you can call these human. By the time we reached the wells, I was as slim and physically fit as I had ever been in my life, but I lamented the lack of a mirror, for I was convinced that this new energy and force that I felt within myself must be reflected in my features, and that my beauty must be enhanced by it. I would have welcomed the opportunity to admire it myself. However, there seemed to be no dearth of others to admire it in my place. At the campfire in the evenings, many a prurient glance was flashed in my direction, and I received more than a few sly offers from my companions, for even such an elite fighting corps as the guards was contaminated by the new sexual license that permeated our society. I kept my dagger beside me in the night, and when I pricked the first uninvited visitor to my sleeping mat with the needlepoint, his yells caused much hilarity amongst the others. After that, I was spared any further unwelcome attentions. Even once we had reached the wells, Tanos would allow us little rest. While we waited for Kratos to catch up, he kept his men exercising at arms and at competitions of archery and wrestling and running. I was pleased to see that Kratos had chosen these men strictly in accordance with my instructions to him. There was not a single hulking brute amongst them. Apart from Tanos himself, they were all small, agile men, aptly suited to the role that I had planned for them. Kratos arrived only 2 days behind us. Taking into account his return to Karnak and the time taken up by the tasks that Tanos had set for him there, This meant that he must have travelled even more swiftly than we had done. "What held you up?" Tanis greeted him. "Did you find a willing maid on the way?" "I had two heavy burdens to carry," Kratos replied as they embraced. "Your bow and the hawk seal. I am glad to be rid of both of them." He handed over both the weapon and the statuette with a grin, delighted as ever to be back with Tanis. Tanis immediately took Lenata out into the desert. I went with him and helped him stalk close to a herd of gazelle. With these fleet little creatures racing and leaping across the plain, it was an extraordinary sight to watch Tanis bowl over a dozen of them at full run, with as many arrows. That night, as we feasted on grilled livers and fillets of gazelle, we discussed the next stage of my plan. In the morning, we left Kratos in command of the guards, and Tanis and I set out alone for the coast. It was only half a day's travel to the small fishing village, which was our goal, and at noon we topped the last rise and looked down from the hills onto the glittering expanse of the sea spread below us. From this height we could see clearly the dark outline of the coral reefs beneath the turquoise waters. As soon as we entered the village, Tanis called for the headman, and so apparent from his bearing was Tanis' importance and authority that the old man came at a run. When Tanis showed him the hawk seal, he fell to the earth in obeisance, as though it were Pharaoh himself who stood before him, and beat his head upon the ground with such force that I feared he might do himself serious injury. When I lifted him to his feet once more, he led us to the finest lodgings in the village, his own filthy hovel, and turned his numerous family out to make room for us. Once we had eaten a bowl of the fish stew that our host provided, and drunk a cup of the delicious palm wine, Tanis and I went down to the beach of dazzling white sand and bathed away the sweat and the dust of the desert in the warm waters of the lagoon that was enclosed by the jagged barricade of coral that lay parallel to the shore. Behind us, the harsh mountains, devoid of the faintest green tinge of growing things, thrust up into the aching blue desert sky. Sea, mountains, and sky combined in a symphony of grandeur that stunned the senses. However, I had little time to appreciate it all, for the fishing fleet was returning. Five small, dilapidated vessels with sails of woven palm fronds were coming in through the pass in the reef. So great was the load of fish that each of them carried that they seemed in danger of foundering before they could reach the beach. I am fascinated by all the natural bounty that the gods provide for us, and I examined the catch avidly as it was thrown out upon the beach, and questioned the fishermen as to each of the 100 different species. The pile of fish formed a glittering treasure of rainbow colours, and I wished that I had my scrolls and paint pots to record it all. This interlude was too brief. As soon as the catch was unloaded, I embarked on one of the tiny vessels that stank so abundantly of its vocation, and waved back at Tanis on the beach as we put out through the pass in the reef. He was to remain here until I returned with the equipment that we needed for the next part of my plan. Once again, I did not want him to be recognized where I was going. His job now was to prevent any of the fishermen or their families from sneaking away into the desert to a secret meeting with the shrikes, to report the presence in their village of a golden-headed lord who bore the hawk seal. The tiny vessel threw up her bows at the first strong send of the sea, and the helmsman tacked across the wind and headed her up into the north, running parallel to that dun and awful coast. We had but a short way to go, and before nightfall the helmsman pointed over the bows at the clustered stone buildings of the port of Safaga on the distant shoreline. For 1,000 years, Safaga had been the entrepot for all the trade coming into the upper kingdom from the east. Even as I stood in the bows of our tiny craft, I could make out the shapes of other much larger vessels on the northern horizon as they came and went between Safaga and the Arabian ports on the eastern shore of the narrow sea. It was dark by the time that I stepped ashore on the beach at Safaga, and nobody seemed to remark my arrival. I knew exactly where I was going, for I had visited the port regularly on Lord Intef's nefarious business. At this hour the streets were almost deserted, but the taverns were packed. I made my way swiftly to the home of Tiamat, the merchant. Tiamat was a rich man, and his home the largest in the old town. An armed slave barred the door to me. "Tell your master that the surgeon from Karnak, who saved his leg for him, is here," I ordered, and Tiamat himself limped out to greet me. He was taken aback when he saw my clerical disguise, but had the good sense not to remark on it, nor to mention my name in front of the slave. He drew me into the walled garden, and as soon as we were alone, he exclaimed, "Is it really you, Taita? I heard that you had been murdered by the shrikes at Elephantine." He was a portly, middle-aged man, with an open, intelligent face and a shrewd mind. Some years previously, he had been carried in to me on a litter. A party of travellers had found him beside the road, where he had been left for dead after his caravan had been pillaged by the shrikes. I had stitched him together, and even managed to save the leg that had already mortified by the time I first saw it. However, he would always walk with a limp. "I am delighted to see that the reports of your death are premature," he chuckled, and clapped his hands to have his slaves bring me a cup of cool sherbet and a plate of figs and honeyed dates. After a decent interval of polite conversation, he asked quietly, "Is there anything I can do for you? I owe you my life. You have only to ask. My home is your home. All I have is yours." "I am on the king's business," I told him, and drew out the hawk seal from under my tunic. His expression became grave. "I acknowledge the seal of Pharaoh, but it was not necessary to show it to me. Ask what you will of me. I cannot refuse you." He listened to all I had to say without another word, and when I had finished, he sent for his bailiff and gave him his orders in front of me. Before he sent the man away, he turned to me and he said, "Is there anything that I have forgotten? Anything else you need at all?" "Your generosity is without limits," I told him. "However, there is one other thing. I long for my writing materials." He turned back to the bailiff. "See to it that there are scrolls and brushes and inkpot in one of the packs."